How does this appointment process work?
The Coastal Act itself has specific provisions for who is to be on the Coastal Commission. There are 12 voting members of the Coastal Commission. Six are at large and can be any six citizens. But the other six, very specifically, are local government officials. It's required that they be local government officials from designated areas from the North Coast, which contains Del Norte, Humboldt, and Mendocino counties, all the way down to San Diego County and the Mexican border. There are six of those. It's divided into six regions. The North Coast region, the upper three counties, is ours. So there will always be someone by law from one of those three counties that'll be on the commission.
And when you say local government, that could be somebody from a county supervisor's spot or from a city council.
Or a city council, yes. Yes, either one of those. It's somebody who is intended to represent a voice with local government experience. That's part of what they're intended to bring to the deliberations of the Coastal Commission. Another thing that they bring, and I think this has been very valuable for Humboldt County, Humboldt County has been the home of the representative on the Coastal Commission for many years now. Going back to when I first came on the commission, it was Tom McMurray, who was then a city councilman in Eureka, and it's been Bonnie Neely and John Woolley and Bonnie Neely again. And what they do is they bring a perspective representative of Humboldt County. And that's very valuable because if you have other commissioners who are from Malibu or from Beverly Hills or from San Diego, they may not know all that much about Humboldt County. And we may do things or think about things a little differently up here than they do, just as they do things differently and think about things differently than we do. And that cross-fertilization of the debate is really important to how the commission goes about its deliberations, trying to take into account the different viewpoints for how best to implement the Coastal Act.
You suggested a moment ago that here in Humboldt County we do things a little bit differently than maybe they do in more heavily populated areas of the coast to our extreme south. But have we actually done things differently in Humboldt County? Is there anything really special about the way Humboldt County deals with the Coastal Act?
Well, one thing that is handled a little differently here than elsewhere in the state is the potential conflicts between agriculture and preservation of wetlands. And in Humboldt County, we, Humboldt County, have what are called at the Coastal Commission farmed wetlands. Many of the old areas along the bay, for example, that were originally part of the bay were diked off 100 or more years ago and drained and turned into grazing lands. Those are still wetlands, but farming, grazing, is recognized as an appropriate activity under the local coastal programs. It's been certified under the Coastal Act, so it's allowed in a way that it might not be allowed. It wouldn't be allowed if you were to try to convert wetlands now.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Coastal Act did and what the coastal plans do is accommodate to the historic use of this particular area that is unique. There aren't farmed wetlands in other parts of the state. It's a pretty unique for the North Coast.
So, Ralph, you bring a pretty unique perspective to this conversation because you're not only, as we've said, the guy who served for 20 years as chief counsel to the Coastal Commission, but you're also somebody who's actively involved in a current case, an appeal to the Coastal Commission. One of the hottest political issues in Humboldt County in recent years has been the dispute over the future of the area variously known as the Balloon Tract or the proposed Marina Center in Eureka. And maybe you could just start by explaining what the question is that's been brought to the Coastal Commission. I should note that you are not alone in appealing this decision. The organization I work for, EPIC, as well as Humboldt Baykeeper, have also appealed that decision.
Yes, and the staff of the Coastal Commission as well
has appealed. Yeah.
And what I'm concerned about, I won't speak for the other organizations, but I think our interests are parallel. What I'm concerned about is that this particular project is really part of a larger project. It is being billed as a pollution cleanup project, but it's really part of the larger project of what the development is going to be in the so-called Marina Center, in the balloon track area of Eureka. And I think we have to start out by remembering that this parcel, the balloon track parcel, is geographically perhaps the key undeveloped parcel in the city of Eureka and maybe in Humboldt County. It's right at the northwest corner of Eureka's territory, fronting on two sides on the bay. It's potentially a beautiful parcel of many possible uses. The owner of the property has focused on a particular set of commercial uses, and they did an EIR for that.
An environmental impact report. Yeah.
I'm sorry, yes, an environmental impact report, which has been challenged and is now being considered in the courts. After that occurred, they did not go forward with that plan to the Coastal Commission, which is what one might have thought would be the next step. Instead, they stopped and waited for a while and then came back with a proposed cleanup plan. I don't see how anybody can be opposed to cleaning up the pollution in this brownfield site. It's an area that needs to be cleaned up. But what they
and
did,
why does it need to be cleaned up? We haven't touched on that.
It needs to be cleaned up because pursuant to the railroad activities and the diesel storage activities, the various industrial activities that occurred on the site historically, there have been a lot of chemicals that have been left in the ground. And some of them seem to be migrating toward the bay or have migrated toward the bay. Security National has been pretty coy about the results of testing that's been done, so it's not clear exactly what's going on. But they are proposing in their supposed cleanup plan to actually grade over the whole site. What this would do is eliminate the wetlands. There are wetlands on the site that I think should be respected under the Coastal Act, and that originally is one of the arguments that I wanted to raise before the Coastal Commission. When they came in with this cleanup plan, that would have proposed as part of the so-called cleanup, eliminating all those wetlands, getting out there with heavy equipment, grading the whole thing over and leveling it, producing what would be called in the cleanup business a cap, after which they could simply put the development on top of it. In their view, all the wetlands would then be gone and there'd be no wetlands that anybody could argue about protecting. So I appealed it because I didn't think that they properly had characterized all the pollutants on the site. I didn't think they had proposed a comprehensive scheme for cleanup on the site. And I didn't think that they had done this in a way to preserve and restore the wetlands that exist on the site. All of those things, I think, should be done. There's unquestionably approvable development under the Coastal Act on the Balloon Track property. Much of that property can be developed. It has wonderful potential as a development for the city of Eureka, but it should be done the right way. It should be done consistent with environmental laws and particularly the Coastal Act. And when that's done, I think there'll be a development that the city can feel really proud of.
So what's the current status of your appeal and our collective appeals?
Well, the appeals are now on hold because rather than pursue those appeals, the developer has gone to court and challenged the jurisdiction of the Coastal Commission, and that's now in the court system. They've asserted that because the city has declared the area to be a nuisance, that they are abating a nuisance and thus they are exempt from Coastal Commission jurisdiction. That was argued in Superior Court in Humboldt County, and the Coastal Commission prevailed. The city and an intervening group who was in the litigation failed at that stage of the litigation. They've now appealed it to the First District Court of Appeal, and that's where it stands.
That brings us to a column that appeared in the Times Standard, I believe on December 10th, thereabouts. Mr. Gary Bird of the Citizens for Better Eureka made a number of points about his perceptions of the Coastal Commission's overreach. But I guess I have two questions immediately about that column. One is, what would be the consequences for California's coast generally and the Coastal Commission if the appellants were to prevail in this claim that the commission lacks jurisdiction where there's an element of nuisance involved in a project?
Well, a nuisance is something that local government has the authority to declare and abate. If they think that there is a particular problem, they can declare that it is a nuisance. They can order the private property owner to abate the nuisance. Right. If the private property owner doesn't do that, they can go in and do it themselves. They have the authority to do that.
And this is an ancient principle
this
of common law.
This is a very ancient principle.
Yeah.
Local governments deal with these things. And if that's what the city was doing, I suspect that the Coastal Commission would have stayed out of it completely. But that isn't what the city was doing. The city lived with this pollution for tens of years. I don't know how many decades it was known to be there. Assuming they were waiting for the railroad to shut down, the railroad quit operating in the early 90s and nothing moved the city to do a thing about this site. It came into this ownership. The city didn't declare this to be a nuisance. They threw a couple sentences in at the end of a long resolution approving the cleanup plan, saying that this was a nuisance. They didn't order the private property owner to abate it. They made no attempt themselves to abate it. It's a sham, in my opinion. They're just using this nuisance language as a way to try to create a wedge to get this past the Coastal Commission without the Coastal Commission applying the Coastal Act policies. The danger with this kind of litigation, if it were to prevail, is that any city can, any local government can, throw a couple sentences into a resolution that don't particularly pertain to what is going on, say it's a nuisance, and then rely on that to say, oh, Coastal Commission, you don't get to apply the Coastal Act policies here because we put these sentences into our resolution saying it's a nuisance. And that's the danger. That's the overreach that would occur if they were to prevail in their litigation.
So it would be, if I may paraphrase, sort of an invitation to local governments to write themselves an exemption from the Coastal Act.
That's exactly right, Scott.
Okay.
Yes.
So my other question about this appeal of the Coastal Commission's authority has to do with the legal group that's doing the work. That my understanding is that the Pacific Legal Foundation, the group that's brought this appeal, has a fairly significant history of opposition to the Coastal Commission. It's in some ways one of their major focuses as an organization. Can you comment on that history and what their role is?
The Pacific Legal Foundation has challenged numerous Coastal Commission actions over the years. Generally, they have not prevailed. The thinking at the Coastal Commission has always been that this is primarily beneficial to them as a fundraising device. They're able to create a boogeyman, the Coastal Commission, and people who respond to that are willing to give money, and hence they perpetuate their organization. Those in the organization can continue to have an organization to try to be a voice for this kind of a point of view. As I say, they generally haven't prevailed, but they've been there, they're trying, and they're continuing to try.
It's interesting to hear that story sort of spun from the opposite direction. That's a claim often made about environmental groups, is that we do this. We do advocacy in order to fundraise, and my perspective has been that it's the other way around. But
I'm sure if you asked them, they would say that they are entirely sincere and the donations are merely a byproduct of what they consider to be the good work that they're doing.
So what are the big lessons you take from the couple of decades you worked with the Coastal Commission and its leadership? What are the important points for California citizens going forward in terms of coastal protection?
I think one thing is to realize its continuing importance, and this may be the most important thing. One of the lessons that we were reminded about, we who were involved in the toll road fight, and I wasn't at the Coastal Commission at that time. I represented the California State Parks Foundation in that particular instance. But what we were reminded of is something that Peter Douglas, who's the executive director of the commission, says quite frequently, which is the coast is never saved. It's always in the process of being saved. It's always being saved. It's an ongoing thing. Down there, we were dealing with a state park. We were dealing with things that people might well have thought were fully protected. We can quit thinking about San Onofre State Beach because it's under state park jurisdiction. It's protected. And that's just simply not the case. Things can come up. Things can change. And so you constantly need to be aware of what development schemes are out there, of how the things that we as a society want to do developmentally relate to how the things are that we want to protect and how those two things come together. That's what the Coastal Commission is really intended to do, and that's an ongoing process. We are always thinking about how we can develop ourselves, improve our way of life, and we are also always being reminded of how important it is to have open space and wild places and habitat and the things that we value as reminders of our role in the larger scheme of things.
Well, Ralph, I really appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you, Scott.
Valuable conversation. Is there a good place for people to turn if they want more information about the Coastal Commission or its actions?
Well, the Coastal Commission has a website that is quite informative, and that would certainly be a good place to start. It's www.coastal.ca.gov, and all of the meeting notices, the agendas are posted, and you can go back historically. If someone wanted to watch the toll road hearing, they could go back to that meeting, that agenda item, and call it up on their computers and watch the whole hearing. There are probably about 15 years of Coastal Commission proceedings that are now preserved in that way, and all of them are continuing to be. So that's a great place to start.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after the air. Thereafter, files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can also find EPIC, the organization I work for, at wildcalifornia.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin, MC Freddie Fred, for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.
This is Uncle Dennis. Free Speech Radio News is having financial problems, not of their making. One of the things that happened a while back was that Free Speech Radio News basically took over the news gathering for Pacifica Network, with the understanding that Pacifica would provide funding. However, Pacifica Foundation has their own economic problems right now, as does the economy, and Free Speech Radio News has not received the money that they were promised by Pacifica. What does this mean for Free Radio Santa Cruz listeners? What this means is that unless Free Speech Radio News gets enough donations to stay on the air, we will lose our 5 o'clock news program. And frankly, we don't have anything to replace it with. There is nothing else available for us to broadcast in the way of national and international news at 5 o'clock. So what I'm asking Free Radio listeners to do is to go to the following website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Have your credit card handy and donate to Free Speech Radio News. Otherwise, we're going to have a hole in our schedule that we really can't fill. I mean, we'll put something there, but we will not have the 5 o'clock news that we have for many, many, many years brought to you. So that's the bottom line. If you like the 5 o'clock news, if you want to hear news at 5 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, you need to break out your wallet, get your credit card out, and go to www.fsrn.org. and make a donation, and you need to do it right away.
And Uncle Dennis will be on at 8 o'clock. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and stay with me for the next 2 hours. We've got a couple of interesting things coming up. A group calling itself the People's Liberation Front. Hope I got the name right. Has sent me an email saying they're going to call in about 10 minutes at 6:15. They claim to be responsible for, quote, taking down the county website around noon today in a protest around the county's prosecution and persecution of homeless activists, specifically the Peace Camp 2010 activists who are facing, in theory, years in jail, or 6 months per charge of the 647E charge of lodging, which is a kind of a catch-all charge used to harass homeless people outside, claiming that they are lodging if they fall asleep with their possessions next to them on public property, and then don't move when asked, though they have no place to move to. And there was a three-month protest starting on July 4th of last year, and I've talked a lot about that protest on the air. Orchestrated by a number of folks. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, was there in force for the first week or so. Ed Fry was both an attorney and an activist, helped to, every night he wheeled in a porta potty that had been rented with the funds from Paul Lee, a local philanthropist and a longtime advocate for homeless people in his way. And the protest went on for 3 months with the purpose of bringing to the community's attention and putting pressure on the city government to change its laws and police practices regarding how they treat homeless people at night. Santa Cruz has shelter tonight, for instance, even with the armory open, for less than 100 and, let's be generous, 180 people at most. Homeless population, I estimate, at 1,500 to 2,000, others at from 1,000 to 2,000. There's a lot of people out there, and they face $97 tickets, which, if unattended, become $397 tickets, which, if unattended further, can result in a misdemeanor charge, which is up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. So it's really a criminalization of poor people in visible places, in where they can be seen, and that is something that's gone on in the Santa Cruz City, progressive Santa Cruz City, as they like to call themselves, under Mayor Rotkin and now Mayor Coonerty, who's our new mayor, who was mayor previously in 2007, and he's mayor again. He's the guy who brought us such fine ordinances as the parking lot trespass law, which I actually call the parking lot panic law. almost unique to Santa Cruz law, which makes it illegal to sit in your car and read a book if you are in a public parking lot, even if it's a free parking lot or you paid for it and you have a right to be there. But you have no First Amendment rights at all there, apparently, according to the laws passed by, well, initiated by Ryan Coonerty, who was then mayor, and then passed by the Santa Cruz City Council. It makes another 10 square blocks of Santa Cruz essentially forbidden, or actually police state zones where police officers can go in and just ID you, search you, demand you leave, stop you from talking to a friend, even if you're doing nothing else. Now, you are allowed, theoretically, 15 minutes to park or retrieve your vehicle, but that doesn't mean you can do anything else. So, in theory, if you're sitting there waiting for a friend or changing the diapers on your baby or, I don't know, pausing so you're pick up an older person who you're helping downtown, that's all illegal behavior. And it's become actually so ridiculous that it's illegal to have a political protest in a parking lot. So the people who were protesting Planned Parenthood, the so-called pro-life people, and those who were defending Planned Parenthood were also illegal when they gathered at the parking lot right outside the back of Logos Bookstore and the Planned Parenthood Center, which is right next to Logos. Of course, the police wouldn't go after those middle-class groups, far from it. They just go after poor and homeless people who are there, and folks like the Drum Circle, where poor and homeless people are invited and can find a respite and community for a period of time, or used to be able to before the farmers market drove them away, and then the police drove them away from their new location at the Soquel, the area on the levee next to the Soquel Bridge. They can still be found, if Drum Circle Dave is accurate, in much reduced numbers in back of India Joe's restaurant on the levee there, although rain has been a problem and a deterrent, I think, in the last couple of weeks. But it's... We have a new mayor. We have ongoing harassment of the homeless. A whole series of laws were used to drive away homeless protesters from City Hall, even though they were not in any way impeding the business of City Hall, even though there was no real indication that they were engaging in any health and safety hazards because they had their own porta potty they brought along. In fact, theirs was the only 24-hour porta potty in Santa Cruz that was open to the protesters and to people, to the public, if the protesters agreed that you could use it, which usually they did, with some exceptions, when I think a huge number of tourists showed up outside the county building, and the original Peace Camp 2010 protest happened at the county building. I think they said, no, no, go find your own facilities. You guys are pretty well-to-do. There's a 24-hour restroom, or 24-hour restaurant, the Santa Cruz Diner, a block away. Go there. You know, I mean, don't fill up this porta potty. We have to be here every night. We're engaging in a political protest. Anyway, a lot of people are facing charges. The so-called Santa Cruz 8 are individuals who face at least 6 months in jail for each charge of 647E, the state penal code, which criminalizes, quote, lodging. And their crime is that they were found asleep at night on the steps of the county building, and they said, we have a right to protest. We have signs. We have tables. We have petitions. And yes, we're here at midnight, but that's because we have to sleep, and we're providing a safe zone for homeless people. And I've been following this case pretty closely. I believe the first trials are coming up for the Santa Cruz 8 in January, or February, thereabouts. There's Ed Fry, who's both attorney and a defendant, because he was arrested as well when he was asked, what are you going to do now? He said, I'm going to go back to sleep because I want to do that. And they arrested him for not getting up and leaving the area, even though they weren't giving homeless people anywhere to go that was legal. And, of course, the city makes it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock everywhere in the city. Well, we have a phone call. Who knows? This could be the promised interview that we were speaking of. Let's see how we're doing and what's cooking and where we're at. Hey there, you're on Free Radio.
Greetings, Mr. Park. This is Commander X of the PLF.
Ah, sounds like you're... Hi there, Commander X.
Are you able to hear me okay, Mr. Norse?
I can hear you, although I sense that you're using a voice disguiser.
Before we begin the interview, I would like to go over some things, and then I will read a brief statement to your listeners and to your city.
Sure, go ahead.
First and foremost, as a field operations commander, I am in a very vulnerable position with regard to my personal security. This is especially true in the immediate aftermath of an action. I may have to disconnect at any moment and without notice. Second, I would ask you and your listeners to get pencil and paper. I am going to read off to you two very short web addresses where you will find some very interesting information that can answer questions that you do not even realize you have. The first URL is as follows. plf777.limewebs. That's one word, limewebs.com. Second URL is sbtplay.se/22640228. I will now read an official statement from the Central Command of the People's Liberation Front to the city and county of Santa Cruz. The People's Liberation Front is now and has from its inception been a non-violent, pacifist group of freedom fighters. Never have we as so much been accused of an act of violence, neither as a group nor as an individual. No one anywhere has anything to be from our group, that is, unless they are evil, criminal, or tyrants. Those have much to fear from us, and they do fear us. For over two decades, we have used information and technology to battle in a nonviolent way to win justice and freedom for everyone. Today's action, as the county spokesman pointed out, did no harm. No books were injected, no databases were violated, and no hardware was damaged. And that will continue to be the case, I assure everyone. But there will be more attacks if the Peace Camp 8 are prosecuted. The op commander for today's action was Commander Adama, our leader. He led the troops who joined with us for today's action from our secret operations center in Massachusetts in the USA. I did not actually join in today's action, although I received minute-by-minute briefs from the Ops Center. I was otherwise occupied doing deep research on your city, your county. At precisely 12 noon Pacific time, the order was given to take down the Santa Cruz County website, and at 12:01, it crashed under withering fire of dozens of high-orbit ion cannons from around the globe that were under PLF command. Listen closely. These cyber lasers are available for download on the website I just gave you. They are relatively easy to use, and PLF advisors are always available online to assist. I encourage all like-minded people who hear this, download an HOIC and join us in action. It is your city. Fight for it. At precisely 12:30 p.m. Pacific time, the ceasefire order was given. At 12:32 p.m. Pacific time, the Santa Cruz County website returned to normal function and became available globally to all our listening nodes. Again, I urge you all to join us. Go to our site, download a laser and scan for human rights, human decency, and freedom in your own community. The PDF is here to help, not to harm. And finally, I call upon all those who hear this, help the Peace Camp 8. Please, write to your government leaders. Go to city council meetings. Dig deep until it hurts into your pockets for cash so they can themselves properly. We actually have faith in your court system. We are not trying to influence your judicial system in any way. Our research indicates that their judge will be more than fair, and they do appear to have adequate representation. But the defense fund is essential. Please look to your hearts and give. Some of these folks are desperately poor, and the defense looks to be elaborate and expensive. We do wish, however, to influence the prosecutor. We believe that this is a malicious prosecution that's politically motivated. We did not need to hack anything to figure that out. We just read your local newspaper archives. So please, if you are listening, prosecutor, it's Christmas for God's sake. Drop these rotten and illegal charges against these humble, innocent, and terribly brave street people. Free the Peace Camp 8. Thank you. You may begin the interview.
Well, thank you, Commander X. I will, of course, for those who don't know what you're talking about, there is an article on the Sentinel website which actually conveys, I think, some of the communique that your group sent to, Curtis Alexander. And I'm bringing it up now, if I can find the right place. I'm sort of interested in what the vulnerability of people like yourselves is. I know there, in terms of legal vulnerability, you know, Julian Assange is, of course, a famous figure who's himself been cut off from funding and so forth for revealing the criminal war activities of various governments, particularly the U.S. government. And in response, there have been what are called cyber attacks on Visa, MasterCharge, and so forth. Was your attack today similar to that against those groups?
It was exactly the same. Only on scale was it different. We only needed 10 cannons. Your county website is very small and does not present much of a web profile. It took about 10 cannons for us to knock it down, whereas to give you an example of what it would take to bring down, we needed approximately 500.
500 what?
Cannons.
Cannons.
As I told you in the statement, we distribute them. They're available on our website. I encourage all of your listeners to go right now and download one yourself. They're very easy to use, and our advisors are standing by to help you. Download one. We aim them at the websites, and we fire the lasers, and the websites disappear.
So you're talking about plf777.limewebs.com is one of the websites.
Yeah, it is.
And the second one is...
That is.
Second one is sbtplay.se/v/2264028.
Correct. Now, the first one that you read is our home website. Mm-hmm. Please understand that we have been involved in many, many actions this week. This website is very vulnerable. One of the reasons we use the URLs that we use is because we are constantly on the move. Should our website crash, though, it will be replaced very, very shortly and available. Just remember our name. We are everywhere.
And again, your name is?
And the second URL is a movie, which I believe that all your listeners and all the citizens in your city should watch. It's very, very available on our home website.
Well, you know, I'm looking at there actually is a new article on the Santa Cruz Sentinel by editor Don Miller, who writes about cyber vandals wage PR attack. Maybe what I should do is read you a little of it and get your reaction, Commander X.
Absolutely.
Santa Cruz County got a taste of cyber warfare Thursday with the county government website rendered temporarily inaccessible to the outside world. And while the damage by a shadowy group that professes to be upset over the county's crackdown earlier this year on illegal campers seemed minimal, such forays are part of a larger movement attracting considerable attention around the world. The irony is that in the name of freedom, such groups are inviting even more government regulation. Thursday's attack by a Cambridge, Massachusetts group calling itself People's Liberation Front, an apropos throwback to the 1960s, mirrors similar cyber vandalism sent out last week by hackers in support of WikiLeaks after Amazon.com banned WikiLeaks from its data centers. Anonymous announced it was targeting the company's vast server network. The attack was ineffectual, and the group, which continues to vow it will wreak digital havoc on any web provider that has been found to slight WikiLeaks and its anarchist founder, Julian Assange, retreated into an attack on a past target, PayPal, the online payment service, along with launching denial-of-service floods at MasterCard.com and Vista.com. There's more to the story. I just kind of want any comments so far.
Well, I first of all would like to, I guess as you call it in your business, give a shout out. There were right this very moment, I'm certain, several members who have fought in the group known as Anonymous over the last week listening to your show. We actually promoted it within our own forum. Quite exciting. We don't get to get on the radio much, you know. They don't really give a lot of interviews to hackers. So, but shout out to my bros. I'm certain that everybody who fought today and everyone who was in the ops center is listening to your show right now. So, my comment would be that the article is incredibly accurate. It's true, as you can read on our website right now, and it is still up. I just checked it. Our forum, however, seems to have been hacked, which doesn't surprise me a bit. But, again, we've been involved in quite a bit of heavy action this week. We've taken down approximately six times we've taken down websites, but we did MasterCard multiple times, twice to be precise. And then at one point there was a split in the command of Anonymous, and immediately after the Swedish prosecutor appealed his bail, the PLF decided to unilaterally take down the Swedish prosecutor's website. And that we had to do on our own because Anonymous would not agree to issue the targeting orders. Hmm. So we took our own troops back and whoever else would follow our charge. And approximately 1,100 cannons stood with us, 1,100 operators, firing multiple cannons in many cases. So 1,100 operators stood with us as we took down the Swedish prosecutor's office within minutes after that announcement was made on CNN that Julian would not be released. We took down that site, and I never felt better about anything in my life, to be honest with you. I was so angry that they held that up. Now, as anybody can read on our website, you can talk about this. Julian was released this morning, and the group command of Anonymous, which we are loyal to, and we stand under that command presently, and it is under a ceasefire. The one thing that we will not do is fire while Julian is at his liberty. Julian can fight his own battles, and trust me, I know Julian, and he will be able to take care of himself just fine. As long as he's not in a cage, and if he can get to a computer, Julian will be fine. So he's in a mansion right now, just about three-quarters of a mile from the courthouse. And I'd like to also thank Mr. Michael Moore. I'm sure he's not listening, but he is, who knows, for posting the bail for Julian. And so Julian is at his liberty now. As far as I know, he's doing fine. We follow the news minute by minute, and we're in constant contact with the central command of the Anonymous operation, as it's known. We have a slogan, We are legion.
Let me ask, Commander,
We never forget and never forgive.
Commander X, let me ask you. I've looked at some of the comments on the Sentinel story, which, by the way, is different than the blog, and you are getting some publicity in the Sentinel, I will say that. The story by Curtis Alexander is headed Cyber Hackers Attack Santa Cruz County Government Website, Briefly Interrupting Service. It's not in today's paper because, of course, it happened today. It's online. It'll presumably be in tomorrow's Sentinel. But there were some comments in the comments section, and one of those comments is, these punks aren't helping Peace Camp 2010 or anyone else. They're just going to bring federal heat onto a local protest. Nice going, jerks. What's your reaction to that?
I got a great reaction to that. You know, I will tell you something, Mister. Does he have a name? Does this fellow have a name?
He calls himself Flag on this
comment. All right. Well, I hope Mister. Flag is listening this evening out there, sir. Let me address some things directly to you. First of all, we were very effective, and we did exactly what we said we were going to do, and we did it exactly when we said we were going to do it. We're holding the cards here. Number two, there have been some 25,000 people standing at one time under what we call a non-ops command. Over 25,000 people, and we've been doing this for a week now. Not one single person has been arrested in the process of these attacks or because of these attacks. Now, if you would follow the news and if you were to do a little research, you'd know that every single attorney who's appeared on every network from CNN to Fox News has said the same thing. This simply isn't illegal. And that's going to be a problem. In the United States of America, these forms of attacks are illegal. They are more akin to a First Amendment expression similar to a sit-in. So good luck trying to attract the feds. Secondly, right now, there is so much going on in cyberspace that you can't even imagine. And the federal government, I assure you, with 800,000 State Department documents floating out there in cyberspace, going from BitTorrent to BitTorrent, the federal government has bigger fish to fry than the PLF. Good luck.
So, Commander X, let me ask you this. You know, there is, of course, I think maybe the public, and that's who you're really, I think, talking to, and that's who the people who are hacking the websites of MasterCharge and Visa and trying
to... These are people, Robert. These are people, Mr. Norris, that are just simply taking their world back, piece by piece, chunk by chunk,
right.
By computer.
I understand, but let me say, though, that one of the things I think they have a certain base of support because people are thinking, at least I'm one of those, and I think a number of people are thinking, if they're not government officials or blinded by media propaganda, that it's really important that people like Julian Assange and others who use the Internet to disperse information about criminal behavior by public government employees and individuals and people in positions of power, that's a really important thing, and that when PayPal and MasterCharge cuts off the funding of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, that certainly is a legitimate cause for a series of cyber attacks that actually economically hurt those groups, at least for brief periods of time. But I don't know.
MasterCard lost $1 million
right,
per
exactly.
minute for 9 hours.
Exactly. But I'm wondering, though, you know, in contrast, people watching this situation, first of all, they never heard of Peace Camp 2010, though maybe now they will, thanks to this because this certainly has a publicity value. Don't you think people might interpret this as a form of trying to, even though you're saying you're not, you're trying to get the prosecutor to drop charges, which, frankly, I think you should do, independently of anything your group is doing or anyone else is doing, simply because these are human rights violations. People have to be able to sleep at night, and also these are First Amendment violations. People have the right to protest the fact that they can't sleep at night. And also, this is exposure of government malfeasance, because the kinds of measures taken by the government in order to suppress this protest have been illegal in some respects, certainly unconstitutional. They set up Klieg lights. They've engaged in jailing people for First Amendment activity. They've arrested homeless people.
We are aware of all of this.
Right, but I'm saying that the community may not be, and that's why I'm kind of talking to both you and the community. But don't you think there's a danger that people are going to say, here's this group of, you know, I don't know, maybe misguided people or thugs, as this guy calls, I'm just calling you thugs. He's saying that, you know, you're causing trouble.
I am.
You know,
I am a thug.
You are a thug. All right, well then, Mr. Thug. What, you know, don't you think, I mean, is this a way of garnering public support for Peace Camp 2010? Do you think this is going to have a positive impact on the community?
Oh, let me tell you something. Right now, at the moment, the download counter on my HOIC is clicking. So I'm thinking this is residents of Santa Cruz taking up my call. And by the time I'm done, there are so many hundreds of people who are going to download this piece of software that we will literally be able to control the entire internet of the county. We will take down any site at our will, at our whim. So I'm not feeling terribly afraid right now, no.
Right, well, I'm just saying, though, can't this be used by any group ranging from neo-Nazis to, you know, pro-life groups to CIA supporters to take down different websites? Yeah.
It's all about the numbers. You know, somebody in Santa Cruz is probably responsible for taking down the forum this morning, right now, this evening. I have another address I could give you. It's a beautiful site. It's where our command, Operation Command Center is. People are welcome to troll information. We release files regularly on how to do different sorts of hacking and whatnot. It's an excellent resource. But it's down currently. It got slammed by DOS just about the time I went on the air, coincidentally. So, you know, that's life. That's cyber war. And, you know, if I find out who did it, I'll take their site down.
Well, you know, I would suggest to you that if you want to get this information out for those who aren't listening to this show or for those who may not have a pencil and paper handy, you might want to go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, assuming it is still up. That's Santa Cruz Indie Media, where I post a lot of my stuff. And, you know, you might want to post something there so people can further...
You know what? I'll leave that to you, Mr. Norris. I publish an awful lot in my own forum when it pops back up out of the mud. But...
Okay. So, well, I don't know. I might do that. And I want to thank you for, you know...
Why don't you go on our forum and you can write some stuff? We hear a lot of good stuff about you.
Oh, well, thank
you. We got a dossier about 3 inches thick on you.
Well, once I'm on your forum, other people may have a dossier 3 inches thick as well. That was one of the reasons I know you invited me to sort of join the chat room and observe the process of the takedown. Frankly, I got an email to that effect earlier today for the community information, but I was not really in a position to judge whether what you were doing was legal and what the implications were for, you know, what a journalist protections were. And, you know, so
the rules, you'll be protected. I said that in the email, and our next embedded journalist will be Curtis from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. If he's listening. I'll wait, Mr. Norris, all right?
No, sure.
I want to speak.
Go ahead.
If Curtis from the Santa Cruz Sentinel is listening, as I probably believe he is, I exchanged several emails with him today, and I'd like to say hello, first of all. Be kind. He was a gentleman. And I'd like him to be embedded in the command center for the next action, if there is a next action. I sincerely hope, though, that it won't be. To be honest with you, you can see, as I said in the communique to the media, I'd like to see the prosecutors simply do the right thing. It's Christmas. Let these poor, simple people go. And then, you know what? You will never hear from the People's Liberation Front again. We will pack up and go.
Well, thank you, Commander X, and I look forward to reports from Curtis Alexander and from you in the future. In the studio with me, by the way, is Steve Plaich, a former city council candidate and a supporter of Peace Camp 2010. Hi, Steve.
Robert, Commander X, I just wanted to say that as a member of the Santa Cruz Coalition in support of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, and as the only city council candidate who was actually endorsed by Peace Camp 2010, I say... kudos to you, and I support your gesture of defiance.
There you have it, a man unafraid to speak
Good
his
evening,
mind.
Sir.
And, you know, I appreciate your, you know, you're raising these issues the way you are. I'm still a little nervous about how it's being done. That's my middle-class upbringing, I guess, Commander X. But, I acknowledge the, you know, the righteousness
well,
of the
you
issues
know,
you're talking
I,
about.
I was prepared for you to say something like that, so I just want to tell you, just as a little dig, because I know you you have quite an activist history, and so does Steve. I would just like to say that this is how us East Coast activists fly.
Right on. Well, maybe you can educate some of us West Coast activists, okay?
I hope to do just that. That's why I'm here in your town.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for calling in, and feel free to call in again at any point.
Yeah, but good evening, Mr. Norris.
Commander. Thank you, Commander X. And let's take a brief breather, a little musical break, and then we'll be back perhaps with your thoughts. Call-in lines are 427-3772, 427-3772, and 469-3119, 469-3119. You're invited to call in. 7 o'clock, we're going to have a call-in from Attorney David Beauvais in Berkeley, who was one of the two attorneys who successfully argued before the Ninth Circuit en banc panel that the Santa Cruz City Council was still going to have to face a trial on the issue of its false arrest of me in March of 2002. So we'll be talking about that. That's another story that appeared actually it appeared in today's Sentinel rather than in tomorrow's as the...
If I may add that it was also on Ruth Snyder did a piece in Santa Cruz Patch on it.
Oh, you know, I'm going to have to get into that Santa Cruz Patch. I keep neglecting to even be aware of them. I've got to start being aware of this group. You want to talk a little bit about what Santa Cruz Patch is, and how people can reach it?
I think they're an Indian news service. I see Ruth Snyder all the time now at most of the committee meetings, council meetings. Ruth seems to cover most of the important issues around town, and I like her writing very much. I think she's done some interesting articles. I know when I first referred you to the website, you weren't necessarily very impressed, I don't think, with the breadth of their reporting, I guess. But now they seem to have really broadened their kind of finding their stride. And I think they're a very good local indie reporting source. So if anybody has local news or they're interested in local news, I think that Ruth and all of the folks there at Santa Cruz Patch are really doing a wonderful job. You know,
and maybe
in covering
Commander
the
X
news.
Can get in touch with Santa Cruz Patch, and they can also perhaps,
absolutely, yeah. I'm sure Ruth would be very, very interested in
yeah.
the goings-on.
Yeah. What's the website for Santa Cruz Patch?
It's just santacruzpatch.com. All one word.
Santa Cruz.
Lowercase Santa Cruz Patch, PATCH.com.
Okay.
And it'll come up.
Well, let's hear a little music, and then I'll be back with a number of things. There was an article in the Good Times, at least a letter by Brent Adams I want to talk about. Again, if you'd like to talk about these the cyber attacks, although it's, I don't know if we call it really a cyber attack, it was more of a sort of a cyber wake-up call to the county website, mm-hmm. because even though it took it down for a bit, it wasn't damaged. It was simply put on alert that the number of people were really upset with the district attorney's prosecution of essentially innocent homeless people for First Amendment activities and for survival activities that violate. These prosecutions violate both the first, both the California and the U.S. Constitution.
And I don't know, Robert, whether you mentioned it when you were talking to Commander X, and of course I don't know that this was specifically designed to be in support of Julian Assange, but we have a protest demonstration at the clock tower on Saturday, 1 o'clock to 2:30. That's an informational, really, gathering for this. Are we still called the Santa Cruz Coalition in support of Julian Assange and
I
Bradley Manning?
I believe it's something to that effect, yes.
But Stephen R.U. actually is the...
He's kind of the key figure in
exactly,
he's one of the
right.
key figures, certainly, who put together this protest, which is going to the first in a series of protests that really it initiated when I asked the former mayor Rotkin to do what Berkeley was doing and perhaps go beyond Berkeley. And Berkeley had a resolution which it didn't pass, but it
I
tabled.
Think they tabled it.
They tabled it. They didn't defeat it. They tabled it, which essentially called Bradley Manning, who's the fellow who. Is accused of passing all these cables.
PFC, Bradley Manning.
A private right. first class, Bradley uh-huh. Manning, to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, hundreds of thousands of documents, diplomatic and military, that reveal all kinds of things, including the murder of civilians from the air without any kind of disciplinary consequences for the soldiers involved.
We might direct people who are interested in the Santa Cruz Coalition in support of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning that Stephen spoke before the city council this last Tuesday. And, of course, that's always recorded by Community TV, so you can go to their archives and you can see what Stephen had to say. Robert, you spoke there as well. I spoke in support of Stephen R. Hugh's statement. So anyone who wants to get a little more background about how Stephen is approaching this, and I think he is spearheading this, really, and he's been the most vocal and certainly the most passionate supporter of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning in town. So, you know, we all owe a lot to him. But if you're interested, you know, maybe archive that on Community TV.
I don't know if they actually have archives, but I know if you go on to Indie Bay, you can see what Steve has written on it. I've written.
Of course, yeah.
That's, again, Santa Cruz Indie Media. That's IndieBay.org/Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so interestingly, it seems to be a very newsworthy time around town with the installation of new council members, new mayor, Commander X, Santa Cruz Coalition in support of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, your verdict from the Ninth Circuit.
The mock Nazi salute stuff.
Really,
yeah.
an incredibly rich time for activism, I think, and news in Santa Cruz.
Plus, we have a new police chief head, Kevin Vogel.
For better or for worse, I think it seems to be a very refreshing time in terms of a heightened interest in a lot of things happening around town, and so it should get everybody's interest peaked a little bit, I think.
It remains to be seen as far as I'm concerned, but I do note that the paper today had at least three stories that interested me, and one of them, of course, was the one that where I won the court case.
And that's about three more than that normally interest you in any given day, right?
Well, usually I don't. Certainly two more.
In fact, we hasten to add that Curtis Alexander is, of course, our favorite columnist for Santa Cruz Sentinel. We've spoken of him here very often in glowing terms.
Well, Curtis is, I don't wish to further disparage a ridiculously bad newspaper, but, you know, I mean, sometimes you can't help but write something that's about something that's significant that's happening, and you have to refer to it one way or another. The other thing that was in the paper today that interested me was the fact that the DIY Last Night organizer this year is coming out with her name. She's saying who she is, and she's saying she doesn't want no stinking permits, which, of course, for those who don't know, there is a parade every year at New Year's Eve that people put together and do floats and costumes and music and dancing and sometimes some leafleting. And I think on different occasions they've had pillow fights, and there's all kinds of stuff that happens. It's a celebration, and it has nothing to do with the downtown association, which frankly has a very bad odor in my view because of its criminalization of homeless people, its support of unnecessarily
criminalization of homeless people. Didn't that Steve Plaich say that in front of the city council?
Between times he was schmoozing with Police Chief Vogel and talking to Martine Bernal, the city manager who cooked up the latest criminalization schemes. Yes, I believe you did make the comment occasionally. We have a caller, though. Let's see what that caller has to say. Hey there, caller. You're on Free Radio with Steve and Robert. Hello? Wait.
Your mystery caller there.
I'm sorry. Speak up again. We missed you. I had your mic down.
My mic? I didn't know.
You're good now.
Yeah, meaning we have to turn you up so you can be heard. Now you can be heard.
Okay. Regarding your mystery caller you had on there.
Commander X.
Okay, whatever his nom de plume is or whatever. To me, if that wasn't the infamous and I think pretty delusional Curb Hugger Chris, is that what you call him?
There is a man called Curb Hugger Chris who's been actually a co-host on my show.
Yeah, I've heard him numerous times, and if that wasn't him, I'll eat tomorrow's Sentinel because.
you don't want to say that because that could be real indigestion coming up. I mean,
will you come to the studio and we can watch you eat that?
Constipation would probably cause it.
Well, I think the issue is not who it was, but rather what was done and why, and what people think about that tactic, and what people think about what the prosecution is doing to Peace Camp 2010. I mean, that's the issue as far as I'm concerned. So.
Well, I mean, I just think your show has kind of lost a lot of credibility over the years, and I think if you're sort of perpetrating, I'm not saying you are, but if you're in collusion with Chris and then you've cooked this sort of little Commander X or whatever, it was a dead ringer for him. I'm not saying it was him, but his speech pattern, and if you take away that whatever that.
But again, you see, the issue for me is not who this was. I mean, let's suppose it was Chris. I mean, frankly, I don't know who it was. And somebody sent me an email yesterday from the, you know, saying it was from the East Coast, saying this was all going to happen. I didn't know what they were doing. And frankly, I was a little nervous about the whole thing because I don't know what the legality, as I mentioned before, of these cyber attacks. It seems to me is a serious matter to take down the county website. That is something that will involve, you know, people getting pissed, and, you know, and if it's across state lines, that can involve the FBI. So it involves a certain risk, you know, and if that was Kerbugger Chris, as you say, and could have been, then you have to decide whether it was a positive thing he did or a negative thing, and that's really, you know, something that you have to judge. I mean, maybe people have made different opinions. I think for sure, I don't know if you're agreed with me, but I think what the county is doing to prosecute the peace camp people is an absurd waste of money and an abusive activity toward those people, and, you know, a slap in the face of the homeless community and, frankly, of the taxpayers and the voters. So that's really, you know, and I mean, Steve here, you've said, you know, right on, you applaud this action. That's what you said to me.
This action?
That the cyber attack on the county website, didn't you
say?
Well,
I think as a gesture in support of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, and they're doing what they feel that they can to be effective.
What about the Peace Camp 2010?
I'm a supporter of Peace Camp 2010.
No, but I mean, as a gesture, and I guess I'm including you, Carl,
you know,
in this discussion.
I'm not so certain about as a gesture in support of Peace Camp 2010, because I would like to see Peace Camp 2010 either revived or Peace Camp 2011 spoken about in terms of that can be a little more constructive. But, I didn't pick the manner of the protest. So,
well, what do you think, caller?
Well, I mean, I don't know where to start, really. I sort of followed the peace camp thing from afar, reading about it, and I saw them at the county building several times. But I mean, like most other groups with good intentions, it seemed like it sort of devolved into this infighting and drunkenness, not rampant, but, you know, and just general chaos, and it just didn't hold together. Kerbugger Chris was part of that.
What about the issue that they were pressing? Because, I mean, that, you know, all these struggles have their internal factional difficulties, obviously. I mean, you aren't talking about the people who are the most resources in the world, nor those who are often the most, you know, stable and certainly have a lot of problems as they go along. But what about the issues, which has to do with the right of homeless people to sleep legally somewhere in Santa Cruz without police harassment?
Oh, I'm absolutely on board with that. I mean,
I'm glad to hear that.
I don't know. I've disagreed with you a lot of times, but one thing I do agree with you on is your. I think it was a perfect little slogan you had. There was the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. I'm totally on board. Since I was living in a van for 3 years before I got my Section 8, so. I'm fully aware of the, you know, the hardships. It is a hard life out on the streets, and I was lucky enough to have a vehicle to live in. But the people that are out there on the street, I mean, that is hard scrabble.
How did the police treat you when you were in your vehicle? Were you pretty much left alone?
Because I was super low key, and I didn't cause any ruckus, and I always threw my trash away, and I was living like in a minivan, so it was very nondescript. The troubles I had were at late at night, where all sorts of people walking the street and rattling your windows, and it was pretty scary, you know. And I'm a male, so I can imagine, you know, a female living alone is.
It's interesting. You're the first person who said that to me. I mean, I've heard people complain that. People like Lieutenant Habey, now retired, but who was a part of a neighborhood kind of vigilante group, would run around and bang on the windows of vans. But it was mostly a police department activity against homeless vans rather than, you know, I don't know, gangs or individuals or other homeless people. But you found it was other homeless people and just ordinary people walking by would bang on your window and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised. How many people wander the streets at night? And I don't mean homeless people. I mean just people that, I guess, have nothing else to do and clearly civilians. They clearly weren't officers, police, or anything like that. Just, you know, the occasional tap on your window or even trying to actually play with the locks on your door and not realizing that there's somebody sleeping in there. Because, like I say, I was in a soccer mom's band, basically, and you wouldn't ever think that somebody was actually living in there. So, yeah, so that's the, and I'm very glad to be out of that situation for that reason.
Well, caller, let me kind of wind this up because I do have other folks coming on, and I've got a couple things I want to say. Anything you want to conclude with?
No, except that if you're saying flat out that you didn't collude with Kerbugger to set this all up, then I'll let it go at that.
No, I didn't set this up. I'm skeptical of its value, frankly, you know, at the same time as I'm supportive of the purposes and the motivations behind it, it sounds like. But thank you for calling in.
Yeah, no problem.
Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. We have about 5 minutes before attorney David Beauvais calls in from Berkeley. A couple things I want to draw your attention to. Brent Adams wrote an interesting letter in the Good Times about the Honig puff piece on the police department in last week's Good Times, Seeing Blue. I'm not going to bother to read it because you can read it yourself in the free Good Times, or you also can read it online. I do intend to do some posting of the latest attack on the I guess it's people involved with the drum circle or trying to use the public space along the levee, a fellow named Nate, apparently, according to Drum Circle Dave, who was a witness, was in essence told by the police, you know, he was stopped and searched and told to sit right down there, according to Dave's claim. And the there he was told to sit in was the area that the police and the Public Works Department has set up as a... It was the place where the drum circle was previously operating. There were trees, there were shrubs, there was a kind of a nice place to gather. It was right next to the Soquel Avenue Bridge across from CVS Market on the levee, and it was completely denuded of vegetation. And he was told to sit down right there, and then when he said, you know, all right, I've done nothing, I want to go, they said, no, you're sitting in an illegal place, and they gave him a ticket. Basket, apparently, the commissioner found him guilty. And I'm going to be talking more about that. We have a caller. Let's see what the caller is. Say, hey there, caller. You're on free radio.
Hello there. This is David Beauvais. How are you doing, Robert?
You're the famous attorney who supports a bunch of Nazis, aren't you?
I'd rather you not talk about my private
life. Ah, yes. Well, we won't talk about your private beer hall activities there.
What's that?
Your beer hall activities will not be the subject of this discussion. And this is all, of course, a lot of... dry or wet wit back and forth here. David, you're a man who's actually, you're a civil liberties lawyer in Berkeley. I guess you're now in Oakland. You've been doing this for decades, right?
Yeah.
And in the studio with me, we have Steve Plaich, who's himself a man who's worked in the legal area for about 10 years as a paralegal.
Well, actually, research attorney. Research lawyer.
Research lawyer, because you do have your law degree.
I do.
And you've all...
Congratulations, David. Wonderful victory.
Thank you, Steve, and nice to hear your voice.
Yes.
So, David, for those who don't know, we're talking about a case that has been going on for 8 years involving essentially a, I don't know, 3-second or 2-second gesture in the Santa Cruz City Council chambers way back in March of 2002. Is that right?
Yeah, I think 3 seconds is being liberal about the amount of time. I think it was a lot less. But
and for those who want, go ahead.
Short.
Uh-huh. For those who want to actually see what happened, the best place to go to look for that is you go to the San Jose Mercury News, and they actually have the video, a video by activist Becky Johnson of exactly what transpired. At least the key gesture, which was a sort of a. I guess was it a left-handed Nazi salute or a right-handed? Anyway, it's the wrong hand, I understand, from those who know Nazi salutes, in response to an action by the mayor, who was essentially treating
a number of people as less than a full-class citizens, first-class citizens. I mean, he ordered one guy, Michael Tomasi, a rather irascible and temperamental fellow, out of the city council chambers after Tomasi had been waiting for 30 minutes to speak, had been promised the right to speak, and it was before the speaking time was up. Krohn, who was then mayor, closed the speaking time, and another activist came up to protest the treatment, and just in amazement, and he told her to sit down, and then I just as I was also waiting to speak. I didn't say anything. I just gave them a brief, don't act like a bunch of Nazis, and turned away. Why did you decide to take this case?
Because I like pure First Amendment cases.
Pure.
That are based upon gestures and, purely protected speech that's clearly protected. And, this case captured my immediate attention, and plus I had known you before, so we have a relationship going back a long time.
Uh-huh.
No doubt that contributed to it as well, and also the fact that it was on video and that there wasn't much to dispute about the facts.
Now, didn't you expect initially this case to be resolved relatively quickly? What was your initial expectation way back in March of 2002? I mean, what happened after that was I was told to leave the city council chambers. I didn't. I sat down instead. The mayor had me arrested with a citizen's arrest. I was taken and held in jail for a number of hours and eventually released, and no charges were ever filed. And that then became, and then I guess 2 weeks later we went back and we began, a number of people gave Nazi salutes to the city council in order to demonstrate that the free speech was still a vigorous activity in some parts of Santa Cruz, and the city council did nothing, I think realizing that they made an error. But instead of acknowledging their error, they chose to defend themselves. Why did you file a lawsuit on this did you attempt any kind of mediation with the council? Did you attempt to change any, I guess it was their rules of decorum you were concerned about, right?
Well, yeah, that was certainly part of it. But I think the reason for filing the lawsuit instead of talking to the city is that I felt that we needed to get the city's attention. And the most dramatic way to do that would be to file a lawsuit. And I think we filed the lawsuit within a week after the incident.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
And, I anticipated that the city would, pony up some dollars, and it would have been a modest amount of money at that time. In order to get rid of this problem, but
well, we're also hoping, if I remember, to change the rules of decorum, which had been introduced in City Council by Council Member Tim Fitzmaurice, the same individual who essentially initiated this arrest, even though it was formally undertaken by Christopher Krohn, right?
Right. And the rules were very disturbing, and they still are disturbing, but. With the Ninth Circuit's interpretation of the rules.
David, as a procedural matter, is the Ninth Circuit that will publish this opinion so that we can use it as a precedential value, so it just won't be a law of the case bound by the facts?
No, it's precedential. There's no such thing as an unpublished en banc decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it says it's published, so... it is.
And is this decision available online for people to actually view and to listen to or to read yet?
Well, you can find it in several places. You can go to the source, the Ninth Circuit website, and click on Opinions Published, and then scroll down to yesterday, December 15th, and it's listed there, and you click on the highlighted name, your name, and the opinion pops up. But it also appears in other places as well. If you just do a Google search, you can find it that way. Because some of the legal sites have put it up there or links to it.
Will it be eventually published in the Daily Appellate Reports and that kind of thing?
Yes, it already is.
Oh, it already is.
It was today, yeah. I think it was today. It was today. And the Los Angeles Daily Journal did an article on top of that about the case.
Well, I look forward to reading the opinion.
And also, the L.A. Times did an article, and I mean, yeah, and the San Francisco Chronicle did an article, and I think there's an AP out there too.
You know, the for those who don't know, the bottom line, as far as I can see, just sort of just summing it up very quickly, and you know, feel free to correct me on this, David, if you think I'm wrong, is that the city council wanted to reserve for the mayor and its city council, the city attorney wanted to do this anyway, the right essentially to order anyone to leave the chambers almost at their discretion, but with the pretext that they were violating a rule of decorum under the claim that if you violate a rule of city council, you have to... you can't be there, even though the Brown Act, the state Public Meetings Act, says you have a right to be at public meetings, you have a right to make commentary at public meetings, you have a right to make commentary that may be even unpopular to the city council that they don't like at public meetings. And they wanted, that they were so intent on maintaining this determination, it seems to me, that they continued to pursue this case. It's essentially what it's gone. It went to a trial court. The trial judge ruled in favor of the city, but the appeal court said no and sent it back. The trial court again ruled in favor of the city without a trial in both cases, and this time the Ninth Circuit Court upheld it. But then this latest panel that you and Attorney Kate Wells spoke in front of said no. This is both for technical reasons and also for substantive reasons. You can't, you know, there were some choice phrases in the decision about that the mayor is not a Führer. you may call him a Nazi, but he can't really act like a Nazi. That's not really, it's a little bit beyond the pale, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, he really invoked a whole bunch of different ideas. The first is that the rules of decorum are now to be interpreted clearly as requiring a disruption. In other words, a mere rule violation unaccompanied by a disruption is not cause to order somebody to leave the meeting.
So if you, for example, stand up at the city council, or if you say nonsense from the city council, maybe you say it loudly, maybe you say it softly, but you say it in such a way that it doesn't interrupt the dialogue of the council, and then the mayor chooses to stop the meeting and turn to you and say, this is your third warning or your first warning, or you have to leave the council because you're violating the rule about talking from the audience. Whatever the rule is, you don't have to leave the council because there's a higher rule, which is you have a right to be at a public meeting unless you're disrupting the meeting in this particular situation. Is that accurate?
Right. Or the other way to look at it is that these rules are in place, but they also, on top of what the rules are, there's some grafted requirement that your conduct or speech causes disruption. Now, I can think of situations where it might. If, for example, they're doing an appeal from some kind of zoning decision, and you get up there and start talking about the Afghanistan war, the speech has to be relevant to what's before the council. Now, during oral communications, as I understand it, in Santa Cruz, you can talk about anything.
That's correct.
But as to other specialized hearings or appeals from administrative decisions of the city, you can't get up there and go off topic. So I think all of that is in place. And if you were to go off topic and persist in going off topic, even though if you're talking in a normal and rational voice and you're not even insulting anybody, that you're disrupting the meeting because you're off topic.
Well, disrupting the meeting would be doing something that is essentially not, it's not so much even violating a rule. It's if the progress of the meeting is, about a particular topic and you're choosing to talk about something else, that can be, I think, reasonably viewed as a disruption. But if, for example, you walk around the room silently with a sign, as, for example, we were accused of doing.
Yeah.
We did it when Mayor Kennedy in 2004 refused to have a public comment period that was accessible to the protesters who were concerned about the sleeping ban. We simply walked around the room once with signs and left quietly. It didn't.
Well, they can make reasonable time, place, manner restrictions.
Of course.
And, walking around the room with a sign might be distracting if it goes on for a period of time. But I'm thinking of that meeting where Kennedy was presiding, where you and several other people walked into chambers and walked between the council members' area and the audience. And, you know, you just did it one time, and then you went to the back of the room, and I think you actually just left. I think
yeah, most people had to leave because Kennedy would not allow an oral communications period, yeah.
Yeah,
and usually that's what happens in the city council meeting. These protests are often prompted by repressive behaviors by the council themselves. And that's, of course, not noticed or understood by the public. And it's something that, you know, is really the motivating factor behind a lot of this stuff. Even
right.
And we have to be very careful because the council can be very arbitrary and high-handed, has a bailiff, has a police department, but the community, if you want to protest it, you got to be very careful. You'll end up spending a lot of time defending yourself and maybe getting roughed up in the process. That happened to me in 2005 when I was arrested for simply trying to take 2 minutes at the microphone on topic on a subject which Mike Rutkin did not want me to talk about, and he was the mayor at the time.
Well, I hope that this decision will make the council and whoever the mayor is a little bit more reflective about the choices they make when they encounter situations that they don't like.
Well, I'm not certain that's going to happen. Ryan Coonerty, who's our mover, has just installed as mayor
not likely,
on Tuesday, had a very pointed comment to make about that in today's Sentinel.
Okay, well, I don't know what he said, but...
Actually, I probably could find the article, and I'll do that as I look here. We're talking with Attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley. By the way, you can call in and ask David questions. We do have a phone line open, 427-3772, 427-3772, or make a comment on the issue. And the issue has to do with the limits of repression at city council. When is sit down and shut up if just... You know, you can't be in this meeting, something that is a permissible behavior by the city council mayor and by city council members. And when is it a form of tyranny and oppression which justifies some kind of legal redress and more important, some kind of change in the way that the city council is operating?
Well, let me take a moment just to read to you Ryan's response. He said, "There is a pattern of disruptive behavior that is at issue here. And we hope the court in San Jose will recognize that we can't have a functioning democratic process when you have somebody who is constantly disrupting the meeting." Unquote.
Is that shall I sue for libel? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. You know, that's sort of an idea that's really not tethered to these facts.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
get back to the case and not broad generalizations.
Exactly.
About
sure.
Some other situation that may or may not have occurred. I live in Berkeley, and I've been to Berkeley City Council meetings that have been disruptive. And, you know, things that are far beyond anything we're talking about here. I mean, situations where, you know, the people just took over the meeting, sat in council members' chairs. My friend's dog, Holly, draped in an American flag, sitting in the mayor's seat during a city council meeting.
Well, maybe Holly'd like to make an appearance down here at our city council.
No, it might liven things up, actually.
Holly has passed.
Oh, my. Well, maybe in memory.
She was a great mayor. And,
well,
we miss her.
Santa Cruz could use a great mayor, believe.
Well, there was actually one time when we did that in the Santa Cruz City Council chambers, but it was not regarded as disruptive. It's interesting. There were a bunch of people who were homeless who came and laid out their sleeping bags all along the floor in front of the city council, but they were very careful to allow a path for speakers to speak. They were quiet, so they weren't interrupting the business of the city council. But then Mayor Keith Sugar said, we cannot operate like this. Although I saw no real impediment to their operating at all, he said, "And what we're going to do," and says, "we're going to adjourn this meeting," and they adjourned the meeting. And so, what we did is the activists took over the city council seats and continued with the next agenda item. And the people who were going to testify were in so much solidarity with us, and they weren't about homeless issues. They came and testified at the next agenda item. We held the council meeting for another hour. Although it was a meeting of the community and it wasn't televised, the televised people went home.
Well, that was kind of what happened in Berkeley, because all of the council just recessed because there was so much commotion. And then we just took over and made it kind of into a, you know, one of those New England town assemblies.
Town hall meeting. Yeah.
You know, and we had some direct democracy for a while.
What a concept. You know, I mean, the thing that really shocked me as I thought back about this whole eight-year lawsuit process, we're talking about almost hundreds of thousands of dollars now that in terms of the money that's owed to you and Kate, right, as far as attorney's fees go?
Yeah, well, they're up there because we've gone through a lot of gyrations on this case.
And how much money do you estimate the city has spent defending this case?
Well, according to them, over 100,000. They said that a long time ago, so I don't know where they're at now.
And so they want to spend more doing this. I mean, to me, it's an incredible arrogance on the part of the city, or at least maybe it's a paranoia they have that they can't back down, a refusal to, you know, to lose face. But, you know, I'm realizing what's amazed me, and again, if you want to see this whole issue, we're talking about the court decision, the Ninth Circuit en banc panel, and on the line is David Beauvais, a Berkeley attorney who was one of the attorneys who successfully argued this case before the Ninth, where I was arrested 8 years ago for a very brief, silent, don't act like a bunch of Nazis gesture to the city council, which was actually not even seen by the mayor. It was seen by another council member who didn't like what I had done. And this really, well, let me say this first, because there was something that, well, the fact that this had to go through, what, courts four different times, and we're still seeing Mayor Ryan Coonerty, who is a teacher of constitutional law at Cabrillo College and at UCSC, somehow not understanding that at the city council, of all places, is one of the most important places for there to be a First Amendment. It is where the community meets the legislators. And the idea that people in positions of power can punish dissenters, which spreads a message not just to the dissenter, but to everybody else in the audience, that they better shape up or they won't be able to be there, and they may even go to jail, is a real acidic erosion on even the possibility of having a democracy in our country and locally at different city councils. And why should this take 8 years to get out before, you know, I guess we're so authority habituated, so authority intoxicated that we have to have 10, it's 10 judges, right? Not 11, am I understand that correctly, that did this? 10 judges in the en banc panel?
No, it's 11.
It was 11. I keep saying 10. My apologies. And I guess, the J.M. Brown, the writer in the Sentinel, was correct. I guess there were only 10 in the room, though. The 11th was right. He was in a distant place when he did it by television.
That was Judge Gould. He was in Seattle.
We argued in Pasadena.
I don't know what's wrong with Judge Gould, but he's been not going anywhere lately. And he seems to be nodding off in the middle of argument. I think he's got some kind of, what do you call it, sleep apnea?
Oh, yeah. No, they're not come to Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock at night. No, that wouldn't be good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what it looks like.
Well, so I'm saying is that it is really chilling isn't quite the word, because I feel exuberant about this decision. I'm really happy that it happened. But, of course, this decision just sends this case after, unless they appeal the decision, the city attorney appeals it to the Supreme Court or asks for a rehearing, and I guess there's some possibility you may ask for a rehearing because you want to clarify a point or two in the decision. I guess.
Yeah, I think we're going to ask for a rehearing on a couple of issues.
And those are more probably technical issues that I don't know if I want to get into on the show particularly, but the key.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about it now.
The key issue, though, that you were able to get has to do with the fact that the city council can't claim you're violating the rules of decorum. Get out, unless you're really disrupting the meeting at the same time. And we got a caller. Shall I? Let me see if we can put him on. We can have him ask you a question. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio with Dave, Steve, and me. Let me turn up your mic, though.
To the Commander X interview earlier, I thought it was pretty cool. My question was, if somebody wanted to call in with something like controversial like that, would they just call this number, or do you guys have like some sort of special line?
No, this is the number you call, and if you want to contact me and be on my show independently, you call 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is also the number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, and Steve also works with here, Steve Plage. Do you have any questions for David Beauvais, our civil liberties attorney man from Berkeley?
No, I don't. Thanks much.
All right. Thank you for calling in, man.
All right. Take care.
Bye. All right. So I'm gonna. I guess I didn't quite articulate why I felt just dismayed. It's sort of like realizing suddenly that in the United States we're in a situation where the president can put you on a hit list, and the courts say that's just fine, and there's no there's no due process at all. And so the same thing is true here at the city council. You know, they can tell you to leave, and it takes 8 years. And if you listen to the discussion, you can actually hear the discussion in front of the court that you and Kate Wells and the city attorney George Kovacevic did with these 11 judges, one of them in Seattle. They were asking a whole series of questions that shouldn't even have come up, that people had to keep asking questions about, well, maybe this contributed to a broader disruption, or really, are they liable for this? When in fact, what we saw was a dissident member of the community who did nothing to disrupt the meeting being struck down in his right to go to a public meeting. And for 8 years, that has stood, and it still stands, because we haven't been able to get to trial yet, and that's still way ahead of us.
Are you going to have David answer any one of these rhetorical
questions? No, certainly not. I'm going to answer them.
Just soapbox, David, go
ahead. Any thoughts on that?
First of all, my reaction to this opinion was to feel a bit hollow, because although it strengthens the law in certain respects and provides guidance not only to the city and other cities, but it also frames issues for this case going forward that are favorable to you. However, I was disappointed that the court didn't just flat out deny them qualified immunity. And because I don't think there's anything here that justifies, there's no way a jury could reasonably find that you created a disruption. And this court made it clear that reactions to your speech, or in this case kind of a symbolic speech, that your reaction, their reactions to your speech do not, cannot be the disruption upon which they rely in suppressing your First Amendment rights. So that point having been made, that means that what's clear here is that there was no disruption. And on that ground alone, forget about viewpoint discrimination and what may be going on in somebody's head when they act. That point alone entitles you to summary judgment, because that was clearly established law based upon earlier Ninth Circuit.
Now let's put that into English for ordinary people to understand. You want me to translate, or do you want to translate?
I can translate.
Go for it.
The idea of qualified immunity is that if you're suing a cop, for instance, for a false arrest, and the law was clear, I'm the police officer acted, and that clearly violated it under that law, then there's no defense of qualified immunity, which basically means that you lose.
Qualified immunity would mean I'm doing it because it was part of my job, and so I'm immune from a lawsuit, right?
Yeah, I'm immune from the lawsuit because what I did, even if it was unconstitutional, it wasn't clear in the law that it was unconstitutional at the time I did it. So I get qualified immunity. I get a free ticket out of this. Now, if the law was clearly established, then there's liability for false arrest.
And you're saying that Mayor Crone and Sergeant Baker and maybe Fitzmaurice and the entire council don't have immunity because it was quite clear that they were shutting down a critic in violation of the First Amendment, not to mention the Brown Act, and that there was no...
The reason that they don't get qualified immunity is that you didn't disrupt the meeting.
Right. They disrupted the meeting.
That's the reason right there, and that's enough for them to have ordered, The only question left after that is your damages. That's the only question left.
So are you actually hopeful that this 11-judge group is going to turn around and reconsider that and say, okay, well, you know, you're right, there's no qualified immunity here, let's just go for damages?
I don't know, but I'm going to put it out there, because that's what the two concurring judges believe.
Yeah, I read that in the Sentinel, or the Chronicle report, said that apparently Chief Judge Alex Kaczynski, joined by Stephen Reinhardt, wanted to go further in their ruling.
Right. And I think there's a basis for doing that.
Go ahead.
They've already excluded, they've already shot down the city's argument that because of your act, the meeting was disrupted. And their reasoning was that because you committed that act and because they had to recess the meeting in order to deal with you, that recess was a disruption. That argument's gone.
And it's gone because, of course, they chose to disrupt their own meeting to engage in punitive action against me that essentially violated my rights to be at the meeting.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you're saying that you're going to hope that by taking this case back to the same panel, even before, you shouldn't have to go through a lengthy trial to show, you know, that they were that they were violating my rights. In essence, the court has said they did. That in essence, that's what has partially been said. And I want to read a little bit from this decision. It says, and this is the entire 11-judge panel. It said that city council meetings once open to public participation are limited public forums. Forums, according to our court. Council can regulate on not only the time, place, and manner of speech in a limited public forum, but also the content, as long as content-based regulations are viewpoint neutral and enforced that way. What a council may not do is, in effect, close an open meeting by declaring the public has no First Amendment right whatsoever once the public comment period is closed. And that was the ridiculous argument being made by the city attorney, George Kovacevic, that there was only a right to speak at the microphone once the public comment period was there, and once that the mayor closed that, anything, gestures, signs, any kind of stuff from the side of the room were inappropriate. Although, he did say that it would be okay, and this probably was his mistake, the city attorney said, it would be okay to give a thumbs up rather than a thumbs down. And of course, what made me chilled a little bit was, so if he had simply said, We will not allow thumbs up or thumbs down in the future, or that isn't really allowed, which wasn't true at the time, and hopefully can't be true now. If we don't allow any of that, then it's okay to hold a completely that's completely content neutral, provided you shut everybody down all the time, no First Amendment whatsoever. I was a little worried about that.
So as I understand, David, so Robert's rights have been vindicated, but it's his damages that are unclear.
Yeah, his damages will go to a jury.
Uh-huh.
No, my rights haven't been vindicated. They're going back to the court, for a trial, unless your rehearing is, in fact, successful. Right, David?
Right. I mean, my rehearing probably will not reopen the case for a new oral argument or anything like that. It'll just simply be that if they would grant the rehearing, they'll probably just revise their decision to take into account, you know, those things that we've raised an issue about.
Now, the point is that you'd rather not go through a long trial than, in essence, to show what the court has already said, that my rights were violated. Why have to prove it again before a hostile judge, who twice has thrown out this case?
Yeah, well, that's my worry. I want to give him the least amount of wiggle room possible. We go back, I'd like to have him straitjacketed into doing the right thing, because the Ninth Circuit told him this is what he's got to do.
Sounds like we have another question coming in, or maybe a caller. Let's see. Hi, caller, you're on Free Radio with David and Steve and me. Hello?
You turn him up?
Yep, he's up. Are you there, caller? Caller. Caller. Hello? Try calling back. I can't hear you. I can't hear what you're saying, if you're saying anything. It has to be said, I have seen this case as an example of part of the pattern of repression of city council. And I know, David, you were involved the year before in defending three of us, the so-called Coffee Klatch Three, not at city council itself, but at the mayor's office, the same mayor who instituted these decorum rules, which we haven't really described. And I don't have a copy of them right here, right now. You can see them. They're printed on every agenda as you walk into the city council meeting. But they have to do with you're not allowed to make remarks that are, I'm trying to find the right words. What is it? Scandalous, scurrilous, very vague standards, which actually are very...
You're not allowed to say any... This is the one that gets me. You're not allowed to say anything that would hold the council in contempt.
Right, you can't hold that would hold the council essentially have a negative opinion of the Santa Cruz City Council, which probably 85% of the Santa Cruz City has at one time or another on one issue or another. So the rules are absurd. Unfortunately, the rules were sort of upheld in the first round of court action we took, provided that they're saying the rules are okay if there's a disruption involved. And now we supposedly found out, according to this unanimous decision, that there was no disruption involved. But here we are going back again. But a year and a half before, the same council member who initiated this, then mayor, Tim Fitzmaurice, tried to have us, well, he had us barred from city council for about a month and a half. He had us banned from the city council offices for 6 months. Do you remember that case?
Yes.
That was an injunction he got claiming that we had set up a homeless coffee clutch where we essentially asked people who are homeless over the winter to come if they wanted to get some, we'd serve them coffee outside the mayor's office and we would kind of, you know, mentor them in coming in to talk to the mayor about the need for shelter in the winter and the need to have a suspension of the city's sleeping ban and police practices involving arrest of people for sleeping at night. And the response to the city to that was to accuse us of harassing the city staff, specifically a woman named Anna Brooks, and then essentially banning us for 6 months from going into any city offices. Do you remember that?
I do.
However, in the end, you and Kate Wells, and again, you got paid, I know you got all kinds of rich money for this one. I think we'll have to double your salary next time. You, as volunteer attorneys, you came in and it took you... How many hours, how much time and energy did you have to put into defeating that injunction that they set up?
I don't remember how many hours, Robert.
But it took you a significant amount of time, no?
It did, yeah.
So what I'm saying is that this isn't the first, this isn't just sort of a lone example of how weird the city council might be on one occasion. This is a pattern of behavior. In my view, what's your impression? I know you're not at the city council as much as I am.
Well, I think there's a clear pattern of basically choking off public participation. And you know as well as I do that there's a number of ways in which they accomplish that.
Yes, by not electing Steve Plake to city council, for one.
The great humorist.
I'm sorry about that.
So
maybe
am I.
Next time.
By the way, we have a caller who's joining us. Caller, are you there? Caller?
Robert, do you mind... Hello?
Hello? Yes, you're on
Hello?
The air. You're on the air, caller.
Hello?
You're on the air. Hello?
This is your host. Hear me?
You're breaking up.
Damn it, Robert.
You're breaking up, caller. Can't hear you. Sorry, man. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You were saying, David, or what were you saying, Steve? What were you doing?
I was just saying, as an aside to this, and I appreciate what you have to say, and I appreciate what David has to say. Do you know that Ronald White was on my moot court panel in law school?
Ronald White, of course, is the judge who has twice upheld the city in this issue, and has been twice struck down, first by the Court of Appeals, and then now by the 11 panel on the en banc panel Court of Appeals.
It's funny, you loved my moot court brief, so.
Yeah,
go
it must have been your good. We have another caller again. Let's see if we can get him on here. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Robert.
Yes.
I was calling to say that you have your levels way off. You can hardly hear David. You are sold out. You're blasting the walls off the doors.
Thank you. Do you have any questions now that we...
I don't have any questions. I just like to get your levels good because you are really loud and we can barely hear David.
All right. Let's try and turn up David and turn down Robert.
You're right.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Say that again.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Testing, testing. I'll try and talk more quietly. I think you are kind of quiet for some reason. I don't know.
Maybe he was just implying that he wanted to hear more of David and less of you.
That could be very likely, actually. Very likely.
I'll try to talk into the mic here a little bit more, too. I'm actually going through a Bluetooth thing.
Okay, that might be good. We're talking with Attorney David Beauvais. The issue is the Santa Cruz City Council's rules of decorum, its behavior toward dissenters, specifically a case where I was arrested many years ago, and I'm still trying to get the City Council dragged into court to change its rules and change its behavior and pay up. We have a caller. Hi there, you're on Free Radio. Hello. Gosh, we're having trouble with these lines. I don't know why, but I guess we're having trouble with these
lines.
Well,
let's just talk to David. He seems more interesting than most of our callers anyway.
Oh, well, be that way, Steve. So, David, what are the timelines involved in this? It's taken you 8 years to get where you are now. What's the story? Are you... if they do... Go ahead.
I don't know if they're going to petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court or not.
The city attorney.
I've read different things in different articles about that.
Uh-huh.
The information I have.
Right.
Assuming that they were to petition for cert and that the court grants cert, which...
By cert, that means the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear it. By the way, caller, you're on the air with David and Steve.
Robert, this is Dennis. I just wanted to make sure that the phones were working.
They are working, although we're having problems with the volume levels, and I'm not quite sure I got the volume turned way down on the microphones, but it still looks like it's way loud. I don't know why.
The show seems to be going from the cream.
Well, I'll see in a few minutes. We'll see what's going on.
Sounds good.
But I think the phones are working. I just think Curbstone Chris has a bad phone location, that's all.
That could be. Thanks. That was Scope It Out Scott who called in with a complaint. So, David, you're saying that the city attorney may try to get the Supreme Court to review this decision, and, I suppose, but what you're going to try to do is you're going to try to get this same court to rehear the decision in the sense that you want to have them to simply say, since it was a disruption, forget the whole trial, just look at the, or try just to find out how much damages are required.
Right, and that would cut off any further machinations in the district court when we get back in front of Judge White.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means it goes to trial. Now, he could let it go to trial and then at the end of the trial say, based on the evidence produced at the trial, I grant qualified immunity. He could do that. And then we'd have to appeal, and if he denied that, then they could appeal.
In other words, he could say that the city council doesn't face any kind of problem with this because they were acting within the scope of their legislative duties. Even if they did violate my rights, nonetheless, they have immunity to that charge.
Yeah, but it would be qualified immunity, not because of their legislative duties. That argument has been killed. In this court.
Well, a lot of these are sort of subtleties I think ordinary people listening to this may not be picking up. Maybe I'm not giving enough credit to people's legal interest. But I think that the nitty-gritty here of it is, do you have a right to come into the city council and, whisper to a friend in the audience, maybe even say that's ridiculous in a way that doesn't stop the city council from going on, but maybe it could be heard by people in the audience. I mean,
well, that's certainly established, but what I'm trying to get to as far as the future course.
Not in the Santa Cruz City Council it isn't established, I'll tell you. Go ahead.
Well, okay, but I mean the future course of this case, we just don't know where the end is, because if they go to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court decides to hear them, now that's going to put us out another, they probably won't hear it until the next term, which will be 2011-2012. And then it would go back down, and the Supreme Court could do any number of things. They could order it to trial, or they could order it back to the Ninth Circuit to tweak something or other in its opinion. There's a lot of different possibilities. And then once we get to trial, anybody could appeal the results of the trial, which was send it back up the chain again.
So the Santa Cruz taxpayers are going to be, as long as they allow City Attorney John Barisoni and Mayor Coonerty and his counsel to continue this case, it could cost a hell of a lot more money for the city, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even if you lose, it could cost a hell of a lot more money.
Right, because, I mean, if we lose, I mean, have to evaluate it at the time, but if we lose because Judge White has made some kind of holding that we don't agree with, you know, then we have to go, we have to appeal that. Or if there's some problem in the trial, we could appeal it. So,
and so our grandchildren will still be debating this case in 15 years or 20 years or 30 years.
Oh, yeah, personally, I've put it in my will.
Nicholas Nickleby strikes again. Isn't it Nicholas
Nickleby?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. You know, it's just really speculative.
So, you know, as I said to you, and I continue to say throughout this, people tell me, well, it's a very important First Amendment case. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And my answer is if you know, one-tenth of the energy and the expense that we've been put in, had been put into, I don't know, a homeless civil rights case to allow homeless people to sleep legally, not everywhere and anywhere, but somewhere, it would produce a lot more benefit. But the problem is, that's a much more difficult case to do. This would seem to be like a pretty much of a slam dunk when we started out, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And once it wasn't, we just kept going. And that's where we are now. Although I think whatever the brave front that Coonerty and City Attorney Barisoni and the City Attorney who argued at Kovacevic say, they must be slapped down by statements like, we note that we've been, and this is the court ruling unanimously saying, we note that we've been unable to find a single First Amendment case where a person has the right to be in a place but has no First Amendment rights once there. Rather, the First Amendment test itself accounts for the nature of the forum, and its most restrictive only permits viewpoints neutral that are reasonable in light of the purposes served by the forum. I wanted to find something that's a little more of a zinger, because they've got a couple of zingers in this decision. We must respectfully reject the city's attempt to engage us in doublespeak. Actual disruption means actual disruption. It does not mean constructive disruption, technical disruption, virtual disruption, nunc pro tunc, whatever that is, disruption. What does it mean?
The Latin term means now for then, then for now for then.
I'm not sure what that means in this context. It doesn't mean imaginary disruption. The city, again, this is the court talking, not me or David or you, Steve, the city cannot define disruption so as to include non-disruption to invoke the aid of a previous court decision. City officials are not entitled to absolute immunity. And so, of course, the opinion of two other judges in concurring with this were even stronger. But the entire court seemed to be slapping at the city councils and the city attorneys here. And that seems to me to be a real positive accomplishment, David.
It seems to be what?
A real positive accomplishment that you've done here.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I have much to do with that. I think that the city attorney did that himself during the oral argument.
That's true. He strangled himself. People really have got to go to the Ninth Circuit website to hear City Attorney George Kovacevic garrote himself. It is amazing to watch him strangle himself. He makes claims that are, you know, he talks about how it's really okay to have a thumbs up, but it's not okay to have a thumbs down. After all, we want to have civility at the city council. And this, in a way, kind of mirrors what the Downtown Association wants to do in Santa Cruz. They want to have, you know, they want to see a very positive city where you can have lots of friendly First Amendment activity, but nothing that's really critical of anything that's going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that the Downtown Association are the ones that are driving this thing.
Really?
You know, that's where the power is, and, you know, that's where the tax dollars are. I mean, I think part of this is economics. I'm not sure that, you know...
Why waste so much money on this case, though? I mean, you know, what the city council has a lot of power So it lets people, you know, make an occasional, put up a sign, make a Nazi salute, say, you're a bunch of bums, whatever. As long as it, you know, they have, the city council can always, when actual disruption occurs, they can always have you arrested and probably convicted of criminal behavior. Why waste so much time and energy on someone like me?
Well, I think that part of the motivation here and is that not only, this is not just about the Santa Cruz City Council. This is about public fora, limited public fora, legislative, local legislatures all over the place who are seeking to gain some kind of control, an impermissible control over the proceeding. And, you know, and I think what inspired that is language in earlier Ninth Circuit cases talking about how much the chair of the meeting has a great deal of discretion. And, you know, set up a goalpost on one end that was an extremely relaxed standard for these cities and counties to do whatever they want, without really much teeth in limiting them. And so one of the things about your case is that we've now struck a better balance. And so with this decision, the chair of these meetings is going to have to be much more cautious.
Absolutely, that's right.
To assure that they're respecting people's rights. I mean, you know about that case in Illinois where the woman was in a meeting and she made faces and she didn't say anything, but she was kind of like communicating facially some kind of displeasure with what was going on, and they nailed her for that. And there are other cases that have come up in other places where, you know, there was just iron-fisted, I don't know what you would call it, kind of an iron-fisted reaction to public participation. Get in the back.
It's just a long history of what they've viewed as the inherent power of a chairperson in any committee ex cathedra to kind of determine, you know, what's going to be a proper behavior and acceptable behavior in any meeting.
I think it's replicated at the national level where you see, and, you know, executives grabbing more and more power, and I'm wondering if this isn't a form of displacing people's anxiety, you know, blaming the dissenter. If we have more control, more power, more policing, it's going to make people feel better, even as they lose their health care rights, even as the country goes bankrupt, you know, even as we engage in even more damaging wars abroad. I may have some little broad reach this. Here's a caller. Hi, caller, you're on free radio with three of us here.
Well, protect the bailiff class.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, the bailiffs, yes. Well, actually, not a court, it's a city council, but go ahead.
It is interesting the degree to which we are capitulating to the bailiff class, particularly if you have any grip on what's left of the middle class. I want to just mention a website real quickly, UK Uncut. I think your listeners would find that very interesting. There is a possible tide turning. My comments really briefly, Robert, on your Sieg Heil at City Council was, and I have spoken to you about this before, I thought it was tasteless. However, I have to acknowledge your persistence and the principle that is there, and the inability of city, quote, leadership to recognize a fault. And to what degree will they spend themselves in the hole to deny this is somewhat incomprehensible. And it is interesting that there is a video of this blessed event. And yes, they did overreact, but to the degree to which they will not admit a mistake. And here's the thing, too. You know, Norris, and as I said this to you before, I mean, the persistence of Robert Norris when he feels he's principled. And this is very interesting, and we'll see where it all turns. But like I think Mr. Plage said, doesn't look like the city is willing to bend an inch. They're willing to spend $300,000 before they get their qualified immunity, which I think is the probable outcome.
What do you think about
that? The sad probable outcome.
What do you think about that, David? Are they likely to get qualified immunity?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's a possibility in the district court when we go back to Judge White, because he has done that in the past. And one of the troubling things about it, as I said before, is that the Ninth Circuit en banc panel sort of retreated from giving us that. And I think, ultimately, I think that the courts are going to decide that these city council members are not entitled to qualified immunity. Unfortunately, we may not get to that issue until 2013.
Wow.
And so that's the problem, is, you know, trying to get what I think is a very sensible decision on qualified immunity, because it's the law on this is extremely clear. And it comes out of cases from, years before this incident occurred, where the court laid out this requirement of disruption. There just simply wasn't any disruption here. There's no facts to support a disruption. And, to me, it's a really simple issue.
Well, I think what the city is claiming is that Robert Norse's mere presence is disrupting.
Well, yeah,
and
of course.
This was the straw that broke the camel's back.
An opinion shared.
And our skin is very thin. And once again, I say protect the bailiff class. Can I make a final statement, Robert, and then kind of and thank you for letting me get on the air, and thank you to Mr. Bouvet. I would look forward to meeting you someday. Just want to say this. A critical mass can occupy Pacific Avenue New Year's Eve upcoming.
Right. This has to do with the fact that the city is not only going after people who dare to come to city council, they're going after people who just want to have a parade on New Year's Eve.
And you want to talk about, a real hypocrisy other than Robert Norse's situation. It would be Wes Modes, last year's New Year's Eve. He is convicted as the only participant in an event that had 1,000 participants.
Right.
And there is no admission of any kind of wrongness, no apology, no nothing. You're supposed to look the other way and protect the bailiff class and be glad that they're not knocking on your door. And that's where we're at in 2010 and going into 2011 in Santa Cruz, with our nuclear-free zone and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I beg to ask, Robert, I know I've said this before, but where was the ACLU Santa Cruz chapter?
We've been asking that question just recently ourselves.
And for 20 years I've been asking that question. But, I kind of got tired of asking because I realized the answer was the same people are on the board of the ACLU who run the city, and they're not going to – they have such a conflict of interest, they're not going to be able to address civil liberties locally. Bob, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.
We have about 10 minutes left here. Those of you who are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. On the line with me is civil rights attorney David Bouvet. In the studio is research attorney Steve Plaich, and non-attorney and attorney hater and disparager Robert Norse.
The very same.
Who nonetheless makes use, much use, of attorneys. Thank you, David, for hanging in there for 8 years,
Robert,
for three hamburgers and an occasional gas donation.
The one silver lining of this is that if it is litigated out until 2013, I may be on the city council at that point. So,
yeah, miracles never cease. Yeah.
Hey, I'll come down and vote for you.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. That's one.
You have to reestablish a resume.
I'll vote for you frequently that day.
I always say vote early and vote often.
There you go. That's what they say in Chicago, too. Well, I guess for those who are interested in this decision, I'm going to try to post it. I've already posted excerpts from it on the indiebay.org/Santa Cruz or Santa Cruz Indie Media website. David, you have a blog. Are you going to be writing about this issue on your blog?
Yeah, I think it's time to update it.
So how do people get your blog, and when should they start checking it out?
David Bouvet, let's see, it's kind of hard to, it's Res Ipsa Loquitur is the name of my blog.
I can explain that to him, David.
If people can Google for David Bouvet, and that's B-E-A-U-V-A-I-S, it's French, Bouvet, Although I understand your original name was Smith, you pretender, you.
I couldn't handle it anymore.
No, too much confusion. So David Bovais.
It's a complicated story.
I understand. Someday we'll get into that. B-E-A-U-V-A-I-S. If they Google for David Bovais blog, will they find it?
If they Google my name and put the word attorney after it, that helps too, because there's other David Bovais.
And maybe you, Robert, can make a note of res ipsa loquitur here, and we can find it that way as well.
Perfect.
Yeah, and it'll come up. My blog comes up on a Google search.
Great.
Okay. Well, we have another caller. Maybe another question for you before you go. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio. Got any questions for Attorney Bovais?
Well, first of all, congratulations, Robert and Counselor.
Hey, thank
for
you.
For a really long and hard struggle, but as they say, freedom isn't free. That's what a lot of people don't understand in this country. It's not free. And I guess I have a couple of questions, like this hack, Ron White, who's been there forever up in San Jose, along with hacks like William Ingram. Is there a way... and I know in another case, when it came back from appeals, especially coming back the second time, is there a way that you can somehow, I know they don't have to disqualify themselves like they mostly do in state courts when it comes back on appeal, but would it be maybe useful to mount a campaign to say to Judge White, hey, enough already, why don't you disqualify yourself and let somebody else take over?
What do you say, David? Is it time to...
Well, we could make that suggestion, and I haven't given it a whole lot of thought. I mean, for one thing, I'm not 100% sure that this case will go back to Judge White. And I don't know why I feel that way, but I just have this impression that this case might get shunted off to another judge, because there was a new federal judge appointed in San Jose, and a lot of Judge White's cases went to her. So it's possible we may get this case going to another judge as well. We'll just have to see what happens.
Well, it seems like he's what is he, 100 years old now? He's got to be up there in age, right?
Well, he has senior status. In other words, he's been on the court for the requisite period of time, and he's become a senior judge. And that means that he might have a lighter workload because senior judges are allowed to work less than full time. I'm not sure that's what he's doing. But given that status, it could be that this case will be transferred to another court. We're just going to wait and see what happens there before we decide what steps we might take to challenge him, if at all. It's very difficult to challenge a judge, and you can't really do it based on their decisions. It has to be based on some extrinsic fact, like he's getting paid by the other side or, you know, something that's outside his decision-making responsibility. It has to be the basis for disqualification.
Right. Well, let me ask Robert this. Is somebody going to read some of the excerpts of this opinion, read it into the council? I don't know how many council members are there now that were there before, but...
Well, the council is, of course, it's on vacation until January, second week in January, and I did send them a series of selections from this decision earlier today, along with a bunch of other people that I think actually might be interested. But the real issue for me, and I only got 4 minutes left in the show, is, you know, when I walk into city council in January and I, you know, make some comment and Coonerty tells me to shut up and I don't follow the rule, he states, but I'm not disruptive, and he has me arrested anyway, what kind of recourse am I going to have? That's going to be the issue. And really, what can people do to stand up? And ironically, in Santa Cruz City Council, if a lot of people are doing something, the City Council does not make an issue of it. I mean, when a lot of people started chanting, homes, not jails, in 1993, and literally disrupted the City Council, they did lock the chambers, and they did recess, but nobody got arrested. Nobody was taken to jail. Nobody was tried or convicted. And, you know, but individual dissenters get the Bradley Manning treatment. They get, you know, they get harassed. They get singled out. I guess if another incident happens, it can be added to the chain of abuses, David, or is that something that you think is not a very good idea?
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to speculate about that. I mean, obviously, if they violate your rights again,
you know, we'd have to see whether we should file a suit over that.
Well, I would hope, Robert.
I mean, at that point, I think we might be asking for injunctive relief.
Yeah, I would hope, Robert, that you're more comfortable going in there now, knowing that the highest court in the land under the Supreme Court has unanimously, not 5-6-7-4, 11-0, said these guys are full of it, way full of it. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Thank you, John.
It does help, doesn't it?
It might. I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering whether it's going to help the next person who wants to assert her or his rights in front of this council. And I'm frankly, you know me, I'm pretty pessimistic about it. I'd like to be optimistic because, I mean, I'm happy. Everyone's sending me congratulations and, you know, it looks positive in some respects. But again, we're talking about a long struggle to even get further on this case. And the real question is, can there be action on issues that are relevant to poor people in this community in the next few months by the citizenry, you know? And some of that involves coming to city council. I think city council is a dead end. It's going to be a dead end for the next 2 years for a lot of people. But we're all going to be facing a real crisis in this country, and it's going to get worse. And I don't know quite, you know, what to do about it. So,
well, now we have a president who is a constitutional scholar.
Oh, you mean Obama?
Yes, talking about...
Well, Kennedy is also a constitutional scholar. I guess they share that, don't they?
Yeah.
Right.
He's talking about preventive detention.
Right. And for those who don't know, that means locking you up before you do the crime.
Yeah, like Minority Report.
Like a Minority Report. I was thinking the same thing.
Right. Well, that's good. Yeah, so if you're telepathic, you can do that, I guess. But well, David, we're running out of time. We've been talking with David Beauvais, that's B-E-A-U-V-A-I-S, of Berkeley, who, along with attorney Kate Wells, have successfully argued before the 11-person court that you can't dump somebody out of a public meeting in Santa Cruz for making a silent mock Nazi salute, even if you don't like it. That seems to be the what they're saying. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that in principle.
Somebody agrees. Yeah. And so that's good, although how many people want to make mock Nazi salutes? I mean, probably it's not a very large number. But a lot of people are afraid of what the city council is doing. Maybe this will give them a little more courage to realize that they have the right to use the First Amendment, even if Mayor Coonerty doesn't like it. You know, even if Vice Mayor Don Lane doesn't go for it. You know, even if Steve Plaich shakes his head and goes tisk tisk. When he is on the council or advising the council members. And I don't expect that. David, thank you for calling in. Any final words?
No, I guess that's about it. We'll just see what happens going forward now.
All David, right. A pleasure. Thanks for all your hard work.
It was nice talking with you, Steve. Take care.
Yeah, you bet.
Good to hear you, David.
Bye-bye. Okay.
And I think that is about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Apparently... Now suddenly the level's dropped again. Something's got to be done about this show.
Now we'll be adjourning to the Free Robert Norris celebration on Pacific Garden Mall.
We're going to really go to Ryan Coonerty's house and have a special... I'm not sure where we are. I'm going to go eat somewhere, but I will not be in Nazi regalia tonight. Because in Santa Cruz, you know, it's interesting. The real people who are acting like fascists they don't look like fascists at all. They're very amiable folks.
Yeah.
And Steve knows that because he schmoozes with all of them, I'll tell you.
As I journey from the cream
to the dregs. Anyway, thanks for being with me in this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'll be back next Sunday with more of the same. And on Saturday, I invite you to join us in the rain at the town clock, urging freedom for Julian Assange, end of the prosecution, freedom for the Internet, and freedom for Bradford Manning, Bradley Manning, the man who... showed the underwear, the very dirty underwear of the U.S. State Department and that of many other governments. 423-HUFF is the number to call if you want to reach me between shows. And the HUFF website is up. If you want to listen to this show again for some weird reason, it's huffsantacruz.org. See you on Sunday, or see you on Saturday at 1 o'clock at the town clock. And I'll see you on, is it 1 o'clock or 1:30?
1 o'clock to 2:30.
1 o'clock to 2:30 at the town clock. In the rain, bring your rain gear, and we'll do what we can to free
Julian Assange
and Bradley Manning.
And to keep me free, too. Why not?
Yeah, and Uncle Dennis, too.
And Uncle Dennis.
This town puts up decorations right around holiday time, then hands out lots of citations for people who ask for a dime. You cannot sit on the sidewalk, you cannot lean on the wall, you cannot stand in the doorway, you cannot be here at all. This town gets ready for Christmas by sweeping the streets of the poor. Jesus would think it was something. How people don't care anymore. Maybe this town's gotten colder. Maybe the people have changed. This town's concerned about hunger. If it's an ocean away,